This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office seems incapable of prosecuting the cops that killed Freddie Gray. The United States sends its Air Force to defend Al-Qaeda in Syria. And some temporary employment agencies are steering jobs to Latinos and away from Black workers.
But first, Great Britain will begin the process of leaving the European Union after a historic referendum last week. Capitalists all over the planet are upset. We spoke with Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar with the Black Radical Organizing Committee, and asked, why are rich people on both sides of the Atlantic so worried about Brexit?
Well, first of all, I think we have to say what the political and psychological atmosphere is for the ruling classes in Britain, throughout Europe, and in the United States, and that is panic, a sense of uncertainty, and they're looking turbulence in the eye. I think this is not and cannot be a happy time for those people who run stock markets and big banks and hedge funds and the political systems that grow out of there. So I think we're in a period like we've never been. Martin Wolf of the Financial Times said today that this is the most significant event in British history since World War II. The New York Times is noting that stock markets around the world are in panic. The pound plunged. It's not a good time. People are saying that we might be on the cusp of an epic recession like the one that broke out in 2008. But no one knows what the final outcome will be.
Well, there is no question that the capitalists are upset, but why are they so upset? What does British membership in the European Union mean, and what does its exit mean?
First of all, the vote represented a rebellion of the British working classes against the British ruling elite and against austerity and globalization, etc. Now, Britain is a cornerstone of the global financial order. The city, as it is called, Britain's Wall Street, if you will, is a major financial center. In other words, that's where banks and hedge funds and multinational corporations do business concerning where money will flow, the value of various currencies, and so on. Taking Britain out of that network, or at least lessening its position in it, is a threat to the financial order that has been in place, I would say, pretty much since 1971, when the American dollar, the global reserve currency, went off the gold standard. You see, at this point, a blow like this against the political order is a blow against the financial architecture which governs and manages it. And that is because no currency is backed up by anything except the good faith of the governments that are behind these currencies. So the weakening of the British government, of the British ruling class, of the British two-party system throws the financial order, the currency valuation system into chaos. And that's what we're looking at.
Corporate media like to describe the European Union as some kind of benign assembly of nations that's designed to keep the peace. But actually, it's a mechanism that ensures the control of Europe, of European markets, by big business and most notably the banks.
Well, that's true. And you see, there is a rational kernel to the movement to exit the EU. And the rational kernel is the call for a return of the sovereignty of the British nation state. What the EU represents is a new kind of sovereignty, a sovereignty of banks over citizens. And this movement of populations, this huge number of people who have been uprooted because of war and neoliberal economic policies, which force them from their homeland to other places to become cheap labor without civil or human rights, barely surviving. Hence this clash of native-born labor with immigrant labor and the overall push of the wage and living standards of all workers lower and lower, and creating a situation of poverty and near poverty for the vast majority of working people. So the striving for sovereignty, like taking our nation back, is in essence a thrust against the big banks who operate as super sovereigns, who have no nation, who have no loyalty. Their only loyalty is to their class, and they manipulate and control the lives of billions of people through decisions they make, either about the movement of money, the valuation of currencies, or their policies of war for resources.
The European Union is the enforcer of austerity in Europe, and when a small nation, Greece, balked against the austerity measures that were imposed by the European Union and the different financial organizations, the EU crushed Greece and crushed its sovereignty and made Greece sell off its national assets and descend much deeper into poverty. But this is Great Britain. They can't treat Britain that way.
That's right, because Great Britain is the fifth largest economy in the world and the second largest economy in the European Union. And the pound is a major trading currency in the world. And of course, Britain's alliance with the United States, the so-called Atlantic Alliance, is a kind of foundation of the global financial order, because you have London and New York, Wall Street and the city, as these two principal financial centers in the world. But what this Brexit opens up is the possibility for Greece, Portugal, Spain, and other European countries to leave the European Union. I think, as the French Prime Minister said this morning, that a new Europe will have to be reinvented. My suggestion is that it's going to be very, very difficult, perhaps impossible, to invent a new Europe upon the rules of the old European Union, upon the rules of Brussels and the big banks. I think we're looking at a new moment in human history. And if I might just say, and I think commentators are right about this, along with the British working class, perhaps the big winner in this is Russia, because this plays havoc with the EU's sanctions against the Russian economy. And where does Britain go if it is punished by the EU, the remaining nations in the EU? Well, you've got two places, Russia and China. And that's where it looks like they're going to be forced to go, and therefore the collapse of the sanctions regime, the cruel sanctions that the West has imposed on Russia, must be cracking.
Many Americans are familiar with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that so-called trade deal that would in fact buttress the rights of corporations even above the rights of countries. But they're not familiar with its European counterpart, which is also being negotiated. And negotiations are going on mostly with the EU, with Britain right. out of the EU or coming out in a couple of years. That tends to lessen the chances of that corporate treaty gaining traction on the other side of the Atlantic.
Oh, there's no question. And you're talking about the TIPP. I think it's called the Transatlantic Investment Partnership. No, this is huge. These trade deals, which have meant not just the movement of capital, but capital, and especially finance capital, becoming sovereign over nations, over people, where citizenship means literally nothing, where a government does not protect the civil and political rights of its own citizens, where corporations dominate nations and dominate humanity, if you will. Well, we're looking at a major blow against that, the TIPP, which would unite the United States and Europe, the two largest economies in the world. And this would not benefit working people. It would inaugurate a new stage of the immiseration and impoverishment of the masses of people in Europe and in the United States.
And yet, if we listen to not just the American corporate media, but the British corporate media, this vote, this Brexit vote, was supposed to be just about race.
Just about race? Well, I think, you know, it's so interesting that this new narrative, this new posturing on the part of the corporate media and the intellectuals and academics associated to it is a joke. At the end of the day, this was about class. This was about the victims of austerity and the neoliberal global order saying enough is enough. It was a rejection. It was a negative. There is not yet a path forward. What will the future look like? We don't know yet. But this was about a class conflict. The lines were clearly and boldly drawn. The majority of the British working classes, those people in the former industrial centers of Britain, the deindustrial mine areas, steel areas, manufacturing areas, this is where the vote for Brexit was the heaviest. And I don't think anyone can overlook this. And this wave of class battle, class conflict is going on throughout the world. In France, the movements of the working people, of the farmers, and of course you mentioned Greece, and certainly the same thing is happening here in the United States. The issue being almost the same. So this is becoming a global movement. I would suggest that we're on the cusp of a new moment in history. In Britain, they're referring to the Brexit vote as creating a constitutional crisis, which is another way of saying a crisis of governance, a crisis of legitimacy. The Labour Party and the Conservative Party is going to have to reconfigure its leadership to try to revive its standing with the voters. We're looking at the same thing here in the United States, the potential collapse of the two-party system. And it is under the pressure of the anti-austerity, anti-globalization, anti-financial elite sentiment and instinct arising out of the condition and suffering of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of working people.
And this commonality is why President Obama went to Britain to urge them to stay in the European Union, because capitalists on this side of the Atlantic Ocean have the same interests as those capitalists in the European Union in keeping all of the various governments actually under the sway of these multinational corporate organizations.
Well, you know, Glenn, it's very interesting, and it validates what we have been saying for at least 8 years, that Obama is a tool and mouthpiece of Wall Street. As David Cameron, the still Prime Minister of Great Britain, is the mouthpiece of the financial oligarchs in Great Britain. Obama went to England to talk against the exit from the European Union on behalf of those whose class interests he represents. And that was significant. In the same way, Hillary Clinton, who was linked to the same interests, supported Britain staying within the European Union. This was a class decision of the financial oligarchs and their political minions.
Well, do you think this vote way over there in Great Britain has ramifications for the electoral season here in the United States?
Very, very much. The referendum in England weakens the position of Hillary Clinton vis-a-vis the American population, especially working people. I think the message will not be lost on working people here that the vote in England was against the financial oligarchs, against the Wall Street oligarchs who are running things in this country like a hidden dictatorship, and that Hillary Clinton, who will not release her speeches to Goldman Sachs for which she was paid handsomely, she thinks she has gotten rid of a good part of the emails that talk about her using her State Department position to advance the position of certain banks and Wall Street oligarchs and billionaires. I think this damages her irreversibly, because this election, the 2016 election, will be unlike any perhaps since 1932. With the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt, will be about the economy. We're talking about a fundamental reordering of the economic architecture and those who have benefited from it being challenged. I think Hillary Clinton, as a representative of the status quo, cannot overcome the significance and meaning of this to the American working people who have been impoverished and immiserated by the policies of the very class forces that she represents.
That is, if the city of London, Wall Street's counterpart in Britain, can be beaten, maybe Wall Street can be beaten here too.
I think that's a brilliant way to put it, and that's my point. And this is what this election is about, in essence. Wall Street versus the people. And it will be a struggle over sovereignty, whether we have a right, any rights that the corporate oligarchs need to respect in this moment in history.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia.
In what looked like well-organized political theater, 51 diplomats in the U.S. State Department acted more like employees of the Pentagon this month. They sent an orchestrated message through the department's complaint channels, calling on the U.S. to launch a bombing campaign against the government of Syria. Meanwhile, U.S. warplanes came to the defense of Al-Qaeda terrorists who are under attack by Russian air forces. Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, says the State Department letter signers are risking war with Russia to save U.S.-backed jihadists in Syria.
This is one of those staged, timed leaks, as they're called. There's no names, and different news media said dozens, more than 50, then it was 51 State Department officials putting out an internal memo. So exactly the whole memo isn't clear. And then you have the Secretary of State, Kerry, publicly responding to what he calls an important statement. So this is all really a manufactured ploy to give a strong push for a very dangerous further military escalation. It's political forces who are calling for a, quote, military solution in Syria, all unnamed. I mean, it's really stunning when you think of the way in which news is manufactured in the U.S., that such a report could even surface and then be commented on all over the world and be commented on by top U.S. officials. But what was happening in Syria during this time, that's what's important. The Russian defense minister was visiting Syria and reviewing the small Russian base and made strong statements about defending Syria's integrity as a sovereign state and called for a diplomatic solution. So, of course, the U.S. is officially for a diplomatic solution, always officially for peace, but they publicized this document, this leaked document, calling for a big military escalation. Now, what else was happening during that time was Russian jets bombed U.S.-backed al-Nusra, you know, these terrorist forces. And U.S. jets, F-18s, immediately came in to protect them. And there was almost a clash between the Russian and the U.S. jets. Russian jets pulled back after bombing these forces. And then when the U.S. F-18s left to refuel, Russian jets came back in and continued the bombing of these forces that supposedly everyone is trying to destroy. But of course, the U.S. is always literally protecting and now protecting with their own jets.
Let's make this very clear. Yeah. What you're describing is the United States Air Force acting as a protector militarily of Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Absolutely. That's exactly what was going on, and openly doing so. And then you have the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, calling on the Russian defense minister, who, as I say, is in Syria during this time, just left. It was just arriving. I don't know the exact scenario. It was all within a couple of days of each other, so it's hard to even tell exactly from the news media. But it's all connected, completely connected, where you have the Secretary of State, Kerry, talking about this important statement on a military escalation, and you have Defense Secretary Ash Carter denouncing Russian jets who are bombing the very forces that the U.S. has claimed to also be trying to destroy. And of course, they never have. And this is something which President Putin pointed out publicly at a press conference, held up photographs of ISIS oil tanker convoys. It stretched 1,000 trucks long. He said, you can see this from space. You can see this from satellite. Why do U.S. jets never, ever attack these thousands of oil tankers, these open camps, these lines of other equipment? So now a lot in the world covered this. The London Telegraph, their headline was U.S. jets in showdown with Russian warplanes over Syria. So you can see how really dangerous it's becoming. And what's behind this State Department leak of these anonymous officials calling for a military solution? It's literally happening in the air as they were writing, and it's cover for what is happening supposedly when the U.S. is not engaged in Syria. But they are, with hundreds and hundreds of more troops and all kinds of contractors and upping the funding of the very terror forces that they claim they want to defeat.
The United States, along with Russia, sponsors of a UN resolution that calls on all nations to join in the fight against not only ISIS, but also al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate. But the United States is constantly pressuring Russia not to attack al-Nusra, claiming that the al-Nusra al-Qaeda forces are intermingled with moderate Syrians. I guess the United States is backing up that with its jets over Syria.
That's exactly what they're doing. They want to protect these forces that they have armed, trained, and are absolutely recognized as the terrorist forces trying to destroy Syria, that have been armed through Saudi Arabia, through Turkey. There are today 13 countries involved in bombing Syria who are not in any way invited in by Syria, requested by Syria. It's a completely aggressive action, and they're using it as an excuse to destroy the infrastructure of Syria. Everything from roads to refineries to hospitals to schools to cement plants, electric generators, unable supposedly to touch any of the terrorist forces. And then they objected to Russian forces coming in and actually hitting these very forces.
In terms of international law, each one of these 13 nations, the United States and its allies, are in direct violation, while the Russians are operating within the boundaries of international law because they've been invited in by the sovereign government.
That's absolutely true. The U.S. is in direct violation, as is Israel, as is Turkey and France. And the list goes on of all the NATO countries, Saudi Arabia. They're all actually involved. Their jets are in the air bombing Syria. They say the skies are crowded with all manner of planes. And Syria did appeal, and Russian forces came in 9 months ago. And it actually has turned the war around, because finally the very forces that were trying to rip Syria apart, and that's U.S. policy. Regime change. That's what they want. They want to pull down and take apart the country that had the most advanced infrastructure, healthcare, and education level in the entire region, and turn it into little tiny non-functioning pieces, such as they've done in Libya. That was directly Hillary Clinton's policy, and it's what they want to do for the future. Pull apart these countries and destabilize. It's part of recolonizing the entire region. And it is a completely criminal and, of course, illegal policy. And the UN plays a role totally in collusion with it. And that would also be important to address, the UN role in this, because meetings have taken place around the world in terms of recognizing a new government in Syria that's a total U.S. creation. It has nothing at all to do with the choice of the Syrian people. And it is quite incredible that in 5 years, the way in which the Syrian people have resisted and managed to hold on, it's under incredibly difficult conditions. And yet people flee to the government-held areas because there they know they'll have protection and subsidized food and basic health care. And in the areas held by ISIS and al-Qaeda, Nusra forces have nothing.
Yes, and the United States and its allies get away with this gross violation of international law because the arbiter of international law, the United Nations, operates as if it's in the pocket of the United States. And three of the permanent UN Security Council members are involved in the aggression, the U.S., France, and Britain.
Completely, the UN is in the pocket of the U.S. And I think one of the things that shows this the most clearly is what happened when Saudi Arabia was criticized just in these past weeks in a report on children in time of war. Now, a simple UN report that criticized Saudi Arabia immediately threatened to pull out hundreds of millions of dollars from UN programs to Palestinian refugees. And the UN, Ban Ki-moon, immediately pulled back. Now, why did Saudi Arabia dare to do this? Because the U.S. had done the exact same thing the year before in refusing to allow any criticism of Israel toward Palestinian children, and said, if any mention of Israel is made in this report, then the U.S. Congress will vote to defund the U.N. So this is now an institution for hire, not operating at all as a force for peace. It really is operating as a force. It issues reports, grand reports about human rights and peace. But on the concrete level, any country with the power that is in league with U.S. imperialism around the world cannot be criticized and will not be criticized. And you have, therefore, the Saudi defense minister coming to the U.N., meeting with Ban Ki-moon, and demanding that this be removed, and it's immediately done.
And so we have a situation in which the United States, the superpower, is untouchable, and its allies, Britain and France, are untouchable. And now Saudi Arabia, which wages unlimited warfare in Yemen and is the prime financier of jihadists, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, throughout the Middle East and North Africa, it now is untouchable. Who can be touched? What good is the United Nations in its present posture?
Well, certainly the U.S. is completely untouchable. Exactly. And they have now set up a system where any of their allies, no matter how corrupt and how ruthless, and we're talking about the Zionist entity in Israel, and we're talking about the completely corrupt feudal monarchy in Saudi Arabia, are also now untouchable. And the UN is used as a public relations institution, not for the protection. It runs certain humanitarian programs that refugees are completely dependent on for the next meal. And most of those are usually bankrupt and can be pulled in at a moment in order to create a refugee crisis. The U.S. wants to create a no-fly zone in Syria. What do? They cut off basic meals to millions of refugees, who then did their best to flee into Europe. Now, that was a lot of pressure coming from Turkey for a no-fly zone in Syria. These things are very, very connected, and they have very little to do with defending the people of the world. And the same role that the police play in our cities is the role that the U.S. empire plays in its wars abroad, where they're unquestioned. They can never be convicted or charged, and yet they can charge the people of the world who are struggling for any change, for any progressive step forward. They are targeted immediately by the U.S. empire and its allies.
And the greatest proponent of a no-fly zone in terms of political prominence in the United States is Hillary Clinton, the soon-to-be president, she would hope, of the United States.
That's exactly true. When you see the worst case is Clinton's role in Libya, where it's just a hijacking, complete piracy, and a destruction of the most advanced, highest standard of living, of health and education in Africa, completely destroyed, ripped to shreds. And she bragged about her role. So it's no doubt that more of that is what's completely in the planning. And the Obama administration, who has vastly expanded U.S. drone attacks and military around the world, but is considered not ruthless enough. They want further military escalation because in every position economically, the U.S. empire is losing its footing. It no longer has the capacity that it had in past decades and generations. And so they're trying now through sheer military destructive power to destroy any country that threatens them. And that's why Russia encirclement and China encirclement and endless war in the Middle East. It's really an effort to impose through military measures their continued domination of global markets.
Isn't that amazing that a president who attends to his kill list every Tuesday is considered not ruthless enough?
Yes, and who will be the target by drone attacks? Man who had the Nobel Prize for Peace. And yet they want a more ruthless policy because this policy wasn't strong enough to achieve their aims. And so there are strong forces in the U.S. that want a huge escalation. And they're behind both Trump and Clinton. And their whole determination, the forces that are coming into play to say the choice is either you've got to press for Clinton because otherwise you'll get Trump, and yet who's surrounding Clinton but these neoconservative, absolutely reactionary forces who are seeking to restore U.S. empire, very aggressive measures around the world. It's a dangerous period we're coming into, a very dangerous period, economically, politically, and militarily.
Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition.
The prosecution against the cops involved in the killing of Freddie Gray in Baltimore is batting zero. A judge last week acquitted a police officer of depraved heart murder charges and Gray's death. Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network spoke to us outside the courtroom.
What the system is telling us is that black people have no rights that their police are bound to respect. Because this was a modern-day lynching, and they just gave us a modern-day Dred Scott decision. Freddie Gray was plenty healthy when those cops encountered him, and when they got through with all they did to him, he had suffered fatal injuries. An EMT who saw him when they brought him to the police station said, "What the F did you guys do to him?" But none of these cops, they go and death them in line on us. They didn't see nothing. They didn't hear nothing. They don't know nothing. And that is okay for the court. They have accepted that as a defense. The prosecution has forgotten how to prosecute. Prosecutors who are very good at putting black people in prison. The state of Maryland, 72% of the people in their jails are African-American, so these prosecutors must be good at putting black people in prison. But when there is a cop who murdered a black man being put on trial, all of a sudden they forget how to prosecute. They are not able to bring any charges, and many of them stick. So they are telling us something. And this is a very big reason why I'm a revolutionary communist working to organize an actual revolution at the soonest possible time. And we are down here today standing together with people to say that this verdict is unacceptable. Tawanda Jones, the sister of Tyrone West, who was murdered by police 3 years ago, last month, no police have been charged in that case. They beat him to death, dragged him out of his car, beat him to death, and then said that he had heart trouble. Somehow black people develop heart trouble when they're being beaten, you know, savagely by police, and that's the reason they died, not the savage beating. And other people are down here with us, but the thing is, this system is telling us you got no rights that our police are bound to respect, and that is unacceptable. That's why I'm here in Baltimore, and why I will be in a whole bunch of other places where outrages like this go down.
The prosecution has come up zero in a number of cases. This is just the latest failure to prosecute the cops involved in Freddie Gray. How is the community relating to this series of defeats?
The community is outraged but resigned. And see, that's a problem. People are accepting that there's nothing they can do. And one thing that people in Baltimore in particular are forgetting is that they are the reason there was a trial in the first place. Because if people hadn't risen up in Baltimore, there wouldn't have been a trial. And they should remember that power that they have and then figure out how to make that power manifest, you know, in whatever form they decide is appropriate. But this view that they have no power actually misses what the reality is.
The community did respond in the streets. Lots of folks got arrested,
yes.
And the prosecution didn't fail regarding many of them.
Yes, there's a brother who broke a window of a police car who's in jail now. So in other words, a broken window on a police car means more to this illegal criminal justice system than the broken back of Freddie Gray. That's what they're telling us. And that is a message. We cannot accept that. Because if we accept that, there is nothing they will stop short of bringing down on black people. We should remember we're in America, and the horrific crimes that this system has committed against black people and against others. And if you give the indication that you're going to accept these attacks, there is no limit on what this system could end up doing to you. Part of why people need to stand up and resist.
The prosecution in Baltimore seems to be institutionally incapable of mounting a prosecution of police officers, given the history here.
Yes, exactly. And part of it is very conscious, because this is a case where a lot of people saw the cops brutalize and torture Freddie Gray right at the beginning. There were a number of witnesses. I've run into a lot of them in going through the Gilmore home in the past couple weeks. None of those witnesses have been interviewed by the prosecution to testify. None have been called to testify. So in other words, they don't even want people to come in and testify to brutality and torture inflicted on Freddie Gray. That's what they're saying through this. Additionally, there was sabotage in this case from the inside, because the cop who was initially the lead investigator in this case turned up in court testifying for the defense. In other words, the guy who was supposed to be trying to make the case turned up in court for the defense, helping the cop get off. That's how high the level of sabotage was in this case. On top of the inability or lack of desire as far as trying to convict the cops.
And we have to note that the cop who was acquitted is black, as are others involved in this case, and as a large proportion of the Baltimore police force, and as is the judge.
That's the thing, see, because when the Ferguson thing broke, there was a lot of talk about white cops brutalizing and murdering black people, and they do, but it is not a question of white cops. And I was telling media and others that right from the beginning. I said, look, I grew up in Baltimore. I now live in New York. I have seen a lot of black cops. I've seen a lot of Latino cops. I've seen a lot of Asian cops who play the same role. And there is an institutional role that the police play. That role is they are not out there to protect and serve the people. They are out there to protect and serve the system that rules over the people. That's the reality of their roles. That's actually a quote from Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I challenge anyone to show me where there's a lack of truth in that quote, because again and again, they make that clear.
That was Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network in Baltimore.
Bernie Sanders has conceded that he won't be the Democratic presidential candidate, and lots of his supporters are in mourning. But Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, says activists must look beyond Bernie.
For millions of people, the demise of the Bernie Sanders campaign has led to a political depression, for the two parties have drawn up perhaps the least popular candidates in memory. That is not to say they don't have their supporters, for they do. It's just that both candidates, Donald J. Trump and Hillary Rodham Clinton, have daunting negatives, and that both candidates possess inordinate wealth is to be counted against them, not for them. For this has been a political season of pronounced distrust and distaste of the wealthy. For some, these choices prove the inherent corruption of the political system, which, post the Citizens United decision, has swung more towards wealth than at any time in recent history. These views are reflected more among the young than their elders, for youth tend more toward idealism. But that idealism, that hope, that deep hunger for change, doesn't have to die. Sure, Sanders' presidential hopes have been dashed. But what of the movement that brought him to the table? The issues of a more honest political system, of a more humanistic as opposed to more corporatist healthcare system, the call for an end to mass incarceration, the demand to halt police terror, these issues, not a specific candidate, moved millions. Why not form a new political party? Why not organize a mass political movement? Why not? Why not? the present political system has failed millions. Why does it continue to deserve your support? When the great labor leader, Joe Hill, was being led to the gallows in Utah, he told his friends, "Don't waste time mourning. Organize. Don't mourn Bernie's failure to win the presidency. Organize." To quote that great Pan-African leader, Kwame Ture, "Organize, organize, and organize."
Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking from the bowels of the Pennsylvania state prison system.
Some temporary employment agencies exclude black job applicants. Instead, they send Latino workers to fill jobs for their clients. Alva Ayala is an attorney for the Workers' Law Office in Chicago. His firm has sued 6 temporary employment agencies and many of their clients for refusing to hire blacks. Ayala says temp agencies do the employer's dirty work, providing companies with the most insecure and easily exploitable workers.
We believe that there is a practice out there whereby client companies that have a preference for hiring candidates of a certain ethnicity, a certain race, attempt to use staffing agencies as a way of making discriminatory requests to get workers of a certain race and exclude workers of another race. And they do this, we believe, for a variety of reasons.
Well, what reasons are you talking about?
We think that staffing agencies have a tendency to engage in practices that violate employee rights, specifically the right to be paid for minimum wages and overtime wages appropriately. And if staffing agencies recruit primarily from a Latino base, then that population is oftentimes more vulnerable to that kind of abuse. So there is a financial benefit from having a population that does not know as much about their rights in the workplace and is not as willing to fight to enforce those rights, and it just makes this population a more easy to exploit population. So in a lot of ways, the problem is one of both the Latino and the African-American community, because on the one hand, the Latino community is being screwed by not being paid properly and by being subjected to other forms of abuse, and you know, the African-American population is being excluded from this labor market.
So what we see is temporary companies going after what they believe are more insecure workers and thereby making everyone more insecure.
Yeah, and it's not just wage theft. I mean, we've seen examples where a manager at a particular client company might have a preference for Latino women, and he might have a preference for Latino women because he likes to sexually harass these women. And that person has a lot of control over these workers because he's the person that basically gets to determine who has the job the next day, because it's within his power to basically tell the staffing agency, don't send this person back. So there's benefits to having a vulnerable population if your intent is to abuse that population.
Is it illegal for these temporary agencies to have these kinds of conversations with employers about what kinds of workers they should be referring?
It is absolutely illegal to do that. And some companies might be wise enough to try and develop a code system to try and hide the fact that these discriminatory requests are taking place. You might have a company that refers to African-American workers by a certain code and Latino workers by another code, and it has nothing to do with race. But I think that if you were to go and look at the records of these companies and the email exchanges between these companies, you would find that the number of workers that are being requested by a client company match that code. So you can say, send me 3 handsomes, and 3 handsomes might basically mean send me 3 Latinos. Or if you say, send me 3 lights and 3 heavies, the lights might basically mean send me 3 women, and heavies might mean send me 5 men. So there's ways in which the companies can try and get away with it and disguise the violation, but the request itself is absolutely illegal.
Reminds one of a kind of conversation you might have heard in slave trading circles.
Correct. You know, we view the staffing agency industry as a problem to the extent that it does kind of erode that relationship between an employer and an employee. And the more levels you have between that ultimate relationship, the more the rights become eroded.
We're told of one temporary company that out of 5,000 workers that it referred, 98% of them had Hispanic surnames.
Yeah, it is one of the allegations. As you might know, there have been a number of lawsuits that have been filed in the Northern District of Illinois alleging this kind of a violation. And we think that at the end of the day, if you step outside of some of these client companies and you see who are the workers coming out at the end of the day, that you'll find that the enormous majority of the faces that coming out of these facilities are Latino faces and no African-American faces. And you know, staffing agencies might say, well, that's because we're located in a Latino neighborhood. But a lot of the time, that just depends on how you define Latino neighborhood. I mean, if you're going to define it as if you, within a two-block radius, is a Latino neighborhood, but within a 10-block radius, it's a very mixed neighborhood, then that defense doesn't really work.
Black workers have been historically known to favor unionization and often to stand up for their rights. That seems to make them bad candidates for some temporary labor agencies.
Yeah, I think that in this day and age where the goal, as I mentioned earlier, is to erode the relationship between the employer and the employee and to erode the basic guarantees that employees have, then the last thing you want is a workforce that is going to be prone to organizing or trying to get a union. And it's very hard to get a union in a temporary work setting precisely because it's like trying to organize migrant workers, right? I mean, it's like Cesar Chavez trying to organize migrant workers in California, where the employer can just say, well, you know, if you don't like it, then I can fire all 100 of you, and there's going to be another 100 just waiting to take the spot. Temporary labor is kind of like that. But that doesn't mean that workers can't organize. I mean, even without a union, the right to participate in collective activity and to take action in mutual support of your coworkers is protected by the National Labor Relations Act. But even that is something that in this day and age, I don't think employers and employers utilizing temporary staffing agencies want.
You frequently hear complaints in the black community that Latino workers are taking their jobs, but in the real world, workers don't take jobs from other workers. Employers and their agents do, like temporary agencies.
Correct. And I think that that's a very important point to make, is that if these practices end in a result where the Latino community and the African-American community are pitted against each other, then it's basically a way for the employers to design these practices to win. This is not about that. This is not about dividing the communities. The goal should be to unite the communities because both communities are being negatively impacted by these practices. One community is subjected to all kinds of abuse, and the other community is being excluded from the labor market, but not by design of one community or the other. It's by design of the employers that are engaging in these practices. And there have been some attempts to try to curb these practices. I mean, one of the problems right now is that the temporary staffing agencies are arguably exempt from the requirement to keep track by race of candidates and employees, the same way other companies might be. So there was an attempt to add requirements to the Illinois Day and Temporary Labor Services Act, which is a law that regulates temporary staffing agencies here in Illinois, you know, arguably strongest in the country. But the amendment would have added a requirement that the temporary staffing agencies actually keep track of this information and keep those records. So we think that this would have solved the problem, because if there is no discrimination going on because African-American workers are not taking these jobs, as the temporary staffing agencies say, then these records, which would be stored for a number of years, would bear that out. And if the opposite is true, then those records would also bear that out. but the industry is very well organized now and is fighting all attempts to add these kinds of requirements to the law.
Yes, the discriminators claim that there is no discrimination, and they try to prove it by getting rid of the data that would show whether there is discrimination or not.
Right. It's easy to say, well, you know, if we're not assigning African-American workers, it's because African-American workers are not coming here. And if there's no record of the African-American workers, be it because no applications are kept or no applications are given out to these workers, then it can't be hard to prove. What's not hard to prove, though, is the fact that when you look at those assignments, then something's off when a huge percentage of them have Latino surnames.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.